This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
They don't want anything to be approved that's going to, in their eyes, reduce the price, the cost of extramarital sexuality.
This week, in light of what seems to be an increasing assault by right-wing evangelicals on women's reproductive rights, we bring you from our archives an interview with the author of a terrific book about the Christian right. Esther Kaplan talked with us about her book With God on Their Side in February of 2006. It's about the influence of Christian fundamentalists on the White House, then under George W. Bush, but its lessons are, if anything, more relevant today, during this 2012 electoral campaign, when right-wing theocratic Republicans are running to take back that office from a Democratic president. Later, we'll hear from Dr. Tom Plow about asthma and how to prevent the kind of fatal asthma attack that killed the great journalist Anthony Shadid on February 16th. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Today on Writer's Voice, we talk about the increasing dominance of the Christian right in science and public policy. From women's reproductive rights to the health of the environment to public health around AIDS and STDs, along with a whole host of other issues, the grip the Christian right has on the reins of power has implications for how we live our lives and how our children will live them well into the future. Esther Kaplan has been writing and thinking about this issue for a long time. She's a radio and print journalist and a community activist. A contributing editor at PAS, the National AIDS magazine, she was acting senior editor at The Nation and writes for The Nation, The Village Voice, and other publications. She's also a public affairs radio host on WBAI and WNYE in New York. She's just teamed up with Frederick Clarkson, author of Eternal Hostility, and Chip Berlay, co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, in publishing a new watchdog weblog about the Christian right called Talk to Action. We'll talk with Fred later in the show. Kaplan's book, With God on Their Side, George Bush and the Christian Right, was just reissued in paperback by the New Press with a new afterword by the author. Esther Kaplan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Now, your book, With God on Their Side, has just been reissued in paperback. I wonder if you could say a little bit, before we even get into the meat of the book, are there great changes between the time it was originally issued and now, or do you think it's just been more of the same?
Well, it originally came out really on the eve of the November 2004 elections. And I think that the main thing that changed, and really because of how those elections played out, is that as a country, we kind of woke up to the fact that the Christian right has tremendous political influence right now. I think that people somehow forgot. You know, they might have been aware in the 90s when the Christian coalition was at its height, kind of forgot that this movement was out there building and growing the whole time, putting people in Congress and increasing its power and sway within the Republican Party. And it was really that values vote that was much discussed in the wake of the November election that I think woke people up about it. And then, of course, many of the extremely public machinations that the president and members of Congress, particularly GOP members of Congress, have done since to pander to this constituency, from the Terry Schiavo case to the showdown over the filibuster to this latest Supreme Court appointment, I think have really reminded people just how much political influence they have. Before the November elections, this was flying under the radar to a much greater degree.
Yeah, that's right. Let's now go into the meat of this book. You said that your book actually wants to ask the question, what is the impact of the dogma-driven political movement of the Christian right in dictating American policy? And it seems like every so often the Christian right seems to pop up on the radar screen related to discrete controversies like the battle over teaching evolution. But you really lay out a much bigger picture. And I wonder if you could sketch out for us the outlines of that big picture of the threat that you explore in your book.
Well, for one thing, I think that you really hit it on the head, that we tend to view these as small issue-related outbursts, and that then the movement somehow goes back to its church pews and is quiescent in the meantime. And you know, there are influential books out there. For example, What's the Matter with Kansas argues that this so-called family values agenda has been more or less used to dupe working-class people into voting Republican, voting against their class interests, but they don't actually win that much politically on their values agenda, that it's a sort of a bait and switch. I think this is a fairly common belief. I have a very different take. I really think that they've been winning on the policy front in very visible and not so visible ways. And partly this is due to a kind of meeting of the minds that happened over the course of the last several years between the leadership of the Republican Party and the leadership of the Christian right, each side kind of reaching out to the other and forming a quite deep and solid alliance. Many leaders on the Christian right, James Dodson, for example, who runs Focus on the Family, who's one of the real powerhouses now, used to typically support third-party candidates, to support insurgent challenges to the kind of institutional GOP candidates in presidential runs, people like Gary Bauer or Pat Buchanan. They were not team players in the way that they've become. Now, part of what made them decide to become team players is they had people like Karl Rove and George Bush, people like Bill Frist and Rick Santorum in the Senate, and others who really decided, this is our future as a party. This is the direction that we have to go, is to court these folks. We're going to really start putting forward pro-life, pro-so-called family values candidates, and we're going to court this constituency. We're going to take them seriously. We're going to take their issues seriously, and we're going to deliver for them. So there's been a kind of marriage of the party and the movement, which is new. That's not something that we really had at the height of the Christian coalition in the 90s, for example. And it's really that kind of perfect storm which has allowed all kinds of stuff to happen, both through the Congress and at the executive level. And it reaches into foreign policy. It reaches into environmental policy, science policy, sex education, AIDS, abortion, so many public health and public policy issues.
What's in it for each of them? I mean, it often seems to be almost a strange bedfellows, just in the sense that the Republican Party has been traditionally allied, to the idea of the very rich, and so many people who make up kind of the base of the Christian right are not, you know, as you said before, that kind of, you know, voting against their class interests in favor of what they see as their values interests. So what's in it for both of them?
Well, what's in it for the leadership and what's in it for the constituents or the grassroots are different questions. For example, if you look at, again, back to the November 2004 election, the issue of same-sex marriage, which was being stoked up to really a fever pitch in the months leading up to the election, it's interesting how it's kind of faded away a little bit since then. But at the time, the rhetoric was incredible. You know, this is the end of civilization. This is the end of marriage as we know it. This was very good for the Christian right. Their fundraising appeals had been flagging a bit because people, I think, felt a little safer and a little more complacent with Bush in the White House. And this issue ignited people. It got the fundraising wheels turning again. It got the volunteers and the donations flowing again. It was very great organizationally for the Christian right. All the leaders of all the major organizations banded together, very unusual, to create a single coalition to coordinate their efforts. And at the same time, all those ground troops helped get out the vote for George Bush. So in terms of the leadership of the Republican Party and the Christian right, often they can really work in concert in a way that strengthens each other organizationally. I mean, on the grassroots, it's a slightly trickier question. I think that on the one hand, my experience going to events on the Christian right is that the people are not as working class as we think. A lot of them, I mean, it's very white, but a lot of them are suburban or exurban, middle class, solidly middle class, sometimes upper middle class people who have a strong free market ideology. They really share that with the Republican Party leadership right now. It's almost a kind of Calvinist way of thinking that if you are walking right with the Lord, then you're also going to do well financially, and that government interventions on behalf of the poor are really disrupting the true path to well-being, which is, of course, a religious path to embracing Jesus and therefore somehow magically achieving economic well-being as well. So ideologically, at the grassroots, the solutions the Republican Party is offering do fit in with the theology that conservative evangelical leaders are promulgating out there. And I think the second thing is, people often over the years have made the joke about the Jewish community's voting patterns, saying that they earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. I mean, it's a bit of an off-color joke, but we are, with other demographic groups, used to the idea that people don't strictly vote according to their economic self-interest. And this is true with the Christian right as well. I mean, I really think on the grassroots, people are voting about their values, and they aren't necessarily the same as their economic self-interests, and they're deciding that issues like abortion and gay marriage are the moral priorities of their time.
So you mentioned about the Jewish community. You actually talk about this marriage between the right-wing, let's say fundamentalist Jews, or even just right-wing Jews and right-wing Christians. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, too.
Well, that's such a sad turn of affairs, I have to say. The Christian right's been courting the Jewish community for many years. Many of its key leaders, from Pat Robertson on down, have said very anti-Semitic things in their writings and in their speeches. They've been trying to sort of escape this public image that they're religious supremacists of sort, that their vision for America doesn't leave room for minorities, which in many very important ways it simply doesn't. But they've been courting Jewish support for their political program for a long time because it gives them cover. It allows them to talk about themselves as the religious right, as if it's a multicultural movement, rather than being a very narrow conservative evangelical theology and policy program. They tried in various ways around public school vouchers. That was something where they found a little bit of support starting back in the 80s and 90s. But this whole question of Israel has been kind of a gold mine for them in forging this relationship. And there are organizations out there that have raised millions of dollars for Israel, for supporting Jews from around the world to move to Israel. The Israel Tourism Bureau courts Christian right support.
So they were courting Jews all along. I guess I didn't know that. And now Jews have begun to respond.
Yeah. And you'll see this is no longer an extreme position in the Jewish community. It's a fairly mainstream position that people like Tom DeLay, a close Christian right ally in Congress, are some of the most important friends of Israel in Washington. Now, they're only friends of Israel if you take that to mean uncritical support for the conservative policies of Likud and Ariel Sharon.
For the occupation, you mean.
Exactly, because the Christian right version of supporting Israel is biblically based, and they believe that the entire territory of greater Israel, as the settler movement also calls it, belongs in the hands of Jews, which means no land for peace compromise. They were completely opposed to the withdrawal from Gaza. It's a force that works against, ultimately, the interests of the Israeli people, because it's a force that's going to block any possible road to peace. They can muster up the votes in Congress whenever there's some support Israel resolution or proposal to give more loans or more aid to Israel. They're dependable allies, and the Christian right will turn on the phone lines and the emails, and their Republican allies in Congress will vote the way they're supposed to. So lobbies like AIPAC or like the Conference of Presidents, the conservative so-called pro-Israel lobbies, Jewish lobbies in Washington, have come to really value the support, however short-sighted and ill thought out that alliance is. It's become pretty strong.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Esther Kaplan, author of With God on Their Side. Yeah, and you mentioned DeLay, Tom DeLay. What about the role of the current corruption scandals with Abramoff and DeLay? These used front organizations linked to Christian right ideology. Do you think the taint's going to stick to them?
You know, we'll see. It's very early to figure out how all of this is going to play out. But yeah, I mean, we're at a time in this country where pretty extreme ideas have entered the mainstream, and it seems like it's going to be petty corruption that's going to bring down someone like DeLay long before the extremism of his ideas do.
So it's not enough to, to erode democracy, to engage in policies that have grave implications for life, for the environment, but they can be brought down because they got a little too greedy.
Yeah, but that seems what it looks like. And, unfortunately, we are at a moment, and we haven't talked about this yet, where obviously we're really lacking leadership from the Democratic Party. So some of these really vital issues that we're talking about the future of our democracy and about destructive public health policies and foreign policies, the party of opposition has decided mostly to be quiescent and safe until, by reading the polls, they realize that there's space for them to speak out about the war, for example. They'll never take leadership in opposing any of these policies. They'll wait until it's kind of obviously safe, according to public opinion.
I wanted to kind of get back to some of the issues that you bring out in the book, because I think they're so important. And your book is absolutely packed with details. Sentence after sentence, you just kind of get more and more aghast. And some of the things that I got most aghast on have to do with something that I've been working on for now this past year, and that is I just completed a documentary that aired last week on the impact of HIV and AIDS in the Latino communities of Western New England. Many people I talked to spoke about the devastation that has been wrought on HIV prevention by the Christian right, policies of the Christian right, and how they've played out in government. So I wonder if you could, start telling us about that, talking about needle exchange and condoms and abstinence only.
Yeah, I mean, this is a devastating development on both the domestic front and the global front, I think especially globally. Bush, we have to give him credit, I suppose, he's the first Republican president to ever decide AIDS was a serious public health issue.
But Bush has been getting involved in a way that doesn't really seem to move a scientifically sound or public prevention program forward.
Yeah. To say the least. I mean, this is what's so upsetting, is here we finally have a president who stood before the American people, spoke about AIDS for, I think, 15 minutes in a State of the Union address 3 years ago, and committed $15 billion to combating the global epidemic. I mean, this could have been such a significant positive intervention, and yet what's happened is, on the treatment front, and here we see the power of the corporate lobby within the Republican Party, the money has only been spent on brand name drugs, which means it's buying a tiny fraction of the amount of drugs it could buy to treat people, and we can count that difference in lost lives.
When you say brand name, you mean then people don't have the choice to use the generic drugs.
Right, and so you're buying drugs at $15,000 a year rather than $300 a year, and you can count how many people you could treat if you were paying $300 a year for drugs rather than more than $10,000. And that's what's been going on the treatment side. On the prevention side, it's even more deadly because, and this is not just Bush, this is also the GOP Congress, but when his emergency AIDS bill was passed, they actually wrote into the bill, these are people with no public health background, wrote into the bill that at least a third of the prevention money has to go to abstinence-only education, which is an unproven method, and to the extent that we have any data about the impact of abstinence-only is that people who pledge abstinence take more risks later and put themselves at greater risk for contracting sexually transmitted diseases. So we're funding an intervention to the tune of more than $1 billion internationally that's increasing people's HIV risk.
Right. I think the study said that teenagers may postpone it by several months. I mean, you know, maybe even up to a year. But then when they do have sex, they don't have safe sex.
Exactly. Exactly. And they don't seek out medical care because there's a shame around the fact that they're even having sex. So if they contract an STD, they're less likely to seek out care and treatment. It's creating a shame culture that, you know, anyone involved in AIDS knows. It took years to try to combat that here in this country.
And condom distribution, I mean, there's some incredible monkeying around and really monkeying around with a scientific explanation of what condoms can do. That is, that the condoms are an effective means of preventing STDs, and yet you wouldn't know that, it seems, by going on, of all places, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control website. Could you talk about what these so-called values-driven agenda has done to education around condoms?
Well, yeah, I mean, the official information coming out of CDC, which is the branch of government charged with disease prevention, has been censored and bowdlerized, really, under the Bush regime. And information about condoms that used to give detailed information about how to put it on right and how to use it, which, incidentally, the only reason condoms have a failure rate is really because of people not knowing how to put them on. So this is a crucial aspect of condom distribution and education, is how do you use them correctly. It has been replaced by information about abstinence only, denigrating the effectiveness of condoms based on incredibly dubious misinterpretation of an NIH study about condom effectiveness, and, you know, kind of as a footnote says, well, you know, if you must use a condom, you know, if you can't abstain. We have people at the very top, Randall Tobias, who's been the head of Bush's Emergency AIDS Initiative, was just named the new head of USAID. So he's going to be running not only HIV assistance, but all U.S. foreign assistance. He's a former pharmaceutical CEO. He has no background in HIV prevention, and he's been spouting off publicly that there's no evidence that condoms prevent HIV transmission. You're putting someone in charge of an agency, USAID, that does huge amounts of public health interventions all around the world, and this is someone who's actively undermining public health.
You know, one of the interesting things about this whole issue is how some different agendas seem to come together. There's one agenda, which is to push abstinence, to get rid of family planning and things of that kind, that is to attack science on that so-called values level, and coming together with the idea of defunding government. I wonder if you could connect the dots for us on those two agendas and how they operate in terms of what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, well, this has obviously long been a conservative vision. The conservative endgame is to defund government. Of course, not the military apparatus of government, but not the part that provides corporate subsidies, but the rest of government, the social welfare side of government. And it's found a nice match with the Christian right agenda in a number of ways. I think the president's faith-based initiative is the most obvious place, where here we have an effort to transfer social services from being something that the government administers through a system of public health experts and civil servants and so on, to something that's administered by the church. And I say the church because this faith-based money is only going to churches almost exclusively. It's not going to other faith-based organizations.
You mean like Muslim or Jewish?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Then what you can do is, once you've disinvested government from the services, then it's much more easy to trim the services, because you just end grants here or there. It's not it's no longer a government responsibility, and the presumption, or so they say, it's a little hard to believe that it would be financially possible, but the presumption is these churches will then pick up the slack. So it becomes a compassionate way of ending services that help the poor.
Compassionate?
Well, I use that term in quotes.
Okay.
But, I mean, in other words, it looks compassionate. Who can argue with giving money to those lovely ladies who run the soup kitchen on Sunday to do their good works? But the end game is, first of all, social services now become mixed with religious proselytizing, which is making the constituency on the Christian right quite happy, and secondly, that you open the door to ending these services entirely or radically cutting them back.
And this kind of goes along with the idea that social programs are of the left. Is that right? That the Christian, you know, defunding government and defunding the left becomes conflated in the mind of the Christian right?
Well, and they are actively defunding the left, even as they're dishing out all these $500,000 and more grants to Christian right organizations to run abstinence initiatives, and even to run gigantic multi-million-dollar AIDS programs in hard-hit countries like Uganda, where groups like Franklin Graham's Samaritan's Purse, which has no background in HIV/AIDS, is multi-million-dollar grants to do work there. They're cutting back grants from family planning groups around the country to the tune of tens of millions, defunding these organizations, taking away money from federally funded family planning clinics, and conducting punitive audits of AIDS organizations and comprehensive sex ed organizations here at home. So it really is a 1-2 punch where you channel the money to your ideological friends, and by hook or by crook, you pull it away from the people you see as, or the organizations you see as being allied with the feminist cause or with the Democratic Party. The tragic irony is that in many countries, it's really the family planning clinics, the women's health clinics, that have been able to provide significant HIV prevention and care and treatment, because they aren't stigmatized as just being these AIDS outfits. They kind of have a presence in the community. Women go there to have their children and have a relationship to these places. And the fact that these organizations were defunded by this administration out of its anti-abortion agenda has completely undermined the ability to deliver condoms and HIV, sound HIV prevention and AIDS care.
And yet you point out that these actually lead to increased abortions, ironically.
Yeah, well, there was a fantastic study that was done by Pathfinder International, I think, and a couple other groups looking at the defunding of UNFPA, the UN Family Planning Group, and other efforts to defund family planning organizations. And there are some countries, and Romania was the starkest example, where since the fall of communism, abortion had sort of become the family planning tool of choice there, because it was reimbursed by the state. Other interventions like birth control pills weren't. There wasn't a lot of sexuality education or family planning education out there. So women really were coming back. I mean, there are many more abortions per capita there than live births. So here was a situation where what the family planning groups were actually trying to do is women would come in to get abortions, and they would educate them about using birth control in the future so they wouldn't have to have future abortions. And in effect, what they were doing was reducing the abortion rate by allowing people much less invasive and painful methods of family planning. So the new restrictions, which are that you can't get any federal money if you even refer someone for an abortion or even mention abortion as an option, means that all these women in Romania that are now seeking abortions, that the people who are offering them services can no longer get U.S. money to steer them into other methods of family planning.
Into birth control.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, the sense was, it's, you know, it always takes a few years for the data to really catch up, but the early sense was that this was going to drive up abortions.
Esther Kaplan. I spoke with her in 2006 about her book, With God on Their Side. We'll hear more after the break.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're hearing a 2006 interview I did with Esther Kaplan about her book about the Christian Right's assault on science, the environment, and women's health. It's called With God on Their Side. Just before the break, Esther Kaplan was talking about how the Bush administration's war on funding for contraceptive services abroad, under the influence of the Christian Right, threatened to actually drive up the rate of abortions. Let's pick up the thread right there. We see this really plays up something that has always seemed obvious to me, and that is that the so-called pro-life movement is not, that it's not really so much about abortions.
Yeah.
It's really about controlling reproductive choice by women. And that may seem a fine distinction, but I think it's a crucial one. Do you know what I'm trying to say here?
No, I think it's absolutely true. And I think one of the recent controversies that really clarifies that was the effort of these pro-life doctors and pro-life activists to block approval of Plan B, which is this emergency contraceptive pill that they succeeded through a series of FDA commissioners or acting commissioners in keeping this pill from being approved for over-the-counter sale. And I went to the session where the scientists debated this, the advisory committee in Washington, which Bush had heavily stacked with these pro-life Christian evangelical doctors. And it was so clear from the evidence that this pill blocks conception, and that if the drug company who produced it had evidence that if it were widely available, it could reduce the number of abortions in this country by tens of thousands per year. It's like a perfect example, and there aren't too many out there, where you could maybe actually find common ground between feminist family planners and pro-life activists, right?
Right.
Wrong. Because, in fact, they don't want anything to be approved that's going to, in their eyes, reduce the price, the cost of extramarital sexuality. They believe that if you have a tool like this out there, it's going to encourage teens and young women to have more promiscuous sex.
We're talking this hour with Esther Kaplan, author of With God on Their Side. Well, that's why I don't like the use of the term pro-life. I think it's much more to the point to call these forces anti-choice. And yet, so many people do use the term pro-life.
Yeah, well, that's their term of choice for themselves. I think we clearly know, or the important thing is for us to make sure people know what the pro-life agenda really is. And you're right, it's not just anti-abortion, and it's not even just anti-birth control and anti-condoms and anti-sex education. It really is about reasserting the idea that women are vulnerable, that women need protection, and that women are not capable of making these kinds of vital life decisions on their own. When I spoke with someone at Concerned Women for America, which is one of the most influential women's Christian right organizations, it's a Washington lobby group, the woman I spoke with there has been part of official U.S. government delegations to a number of U.N. conferences on the rights of women and the rights of children. I mean, that's who the government delegations are now getting their advice from, is people like this. And she was very clear that what they wanted to reinforce on an international level was that women are vulnerable. They are more vulnerable than men, and they need to be protected. And this has to do with a conservative evangelical vision of a social order that is very hierarchical, with God at the top, and then the pastor, and then the man, and then his wife, and then the child.
And then the family dog.
Exactly. But you know, the right of the parent to have to be able to exert corporal punishment, for example, over their own children, to control their own children's education, to keep them away from sex ed or whatever, is part also of this same hierarchical vision of family. And so you're right. The restriction on abortion, yes, they've gotten some people very caught up with the whole question of the value of the fetus. But the underlying question is, should women have the power to make a grave moral decision that affects their own bodies and their own families and whether or not to have a child, whether this embryo will be brought to term? These decisions are too profound for women. These decisions should not be in women's hands.
Well, it kind of goes along with the idea that faith trumps democracy. I mean, it's a kind of profoundly anti-democratic agenda. You know, the idea that God is the one who rules. You know, I think you quote General Jerry, the enemy is Satan Boykin, you know, in saying that although most, just admitting that although most Americans didn't vote for Bush, he says, well, God put him in the White House. So that kind of goes along with the same, you know, God's at the top and then the man and then the woman.
Yeah. No, it's actually pretty incredible. I mean, that's faded a little bit since Bush seems to have won the popular vote when he was reelected. But throughout his first term, it was a widely disseminated idea, and one that I heard again and again at Christian right gatherings and conferences and so on, which was that God knew something that we didn't know, and that God figured out that Bush needed to be in the White House for the events of September 11th, and that God, I guess through the Supreme Court, put him there.
Just like the president knows things that we don't know, and therefore we should trust him. And, you know, the husband knows things that the woman doesn't. So, yeah, I think it does fall all the way down, as you show. You know, before we come to an end, I think it's important to also make the link here or connect the dot up with the attack on science, not just as we've talked about, you know, say the science of public health, but also environmental science, or even more generically, the attack on evolution. It looks like they're losing the battle over evolution, though. Does that mean that the public is getting wise to them?
Well, I do think that the Dover case was a useful teaching moment, if you will, in terms of people beginning to understand that intelligent design is just a kind of gussied up version of creationism. So in that sense, the kind of sleight of hand involving intelligent design is maybe not going to be as effective in the future. I think the problem that we're having is that what we're beginning to see on the Christian right, and maybe in its most exaggerated form through the homeschooling movement, but it's happening in Christian private schools and all kinds of other venues, is that there's this alternative reality being created. And in those textbooks and in that alternative reality, there's no legitimate scientific evidence for evolution, and there's plenty of scientific evidence for intelligent design. And America was founded as a Christian nation, and the job of a good Christian is to return it to its Christian theocratic roots. And, you know, the Grand Canyon was created by the flood that launched Noah's Ark. And, I mean, there's just an entire alternative view of how the world works, about how this democracy should work, about the history of America. And millions of people are being raised up with this alternative reality.
You know, it reminds me, even 10 years ago, I remember going to Costco, and I picked up a book, you know, it looked interesting. I couldn't tell from the cover. It was a child's book, and it was about, you know, the history of the world or geography. And I open up to the first page, and it says, you know, the world was created 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just was floored by this, because this was just laid out on a table as if it was just the most normal thing in the world to have a book like this. And I guess it is now to millions of Americans.
It's certainly become incredibly common. And so it is really dangerous when we have the president of our country saying, you know, the jury's still out on evolution. There's evidence on both sides. We should teach both sides, completely fudging the difference between theology and science. And it's the same kind of thinking that surrounds AIDS policy or sex education policy. There was a longtime AIDS advocate who I spoke to who met with the head of domestic policy in the White House, who's now been replaced, but the woman who, Margaret Spellings, who was in that position in the first term. And he was trying to talk to her about the science behind condoms and how we really had a lot of confidence now that condom-based interventions really work. And she just looked at him and said, well, you have your science and we have our science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is coming from the very top, our president, our chief domestic policy advisor. And so you can imagine how this filters down to the grassroots, to a classroom where a conservative evangelical is up in front of the room with the kids, or a homeschooling situation, or a church pulpit.
Do you see any cracks and contradictions in the Christian right, in this whole kind of juggernaut of the Christian right along with power and government? And if so, and I'm hoping you'll answer yes in some way, how can progressives exploit those cracks and contradictions?
Well, I guess I do see a number. I mean, one is just the contradictions I guess we all know about within the Republican coalition, which is that the corporate interests, which provide a lot of the money to the party, the Christian right provides the kind of ground troops, doesn't believe this stuff. And they actually believe in science because they're pharmaceutical CEOs and so on. And science, they know, is crucial to the economy. And they're, in fact, quite worried about the United States lagging behind on biotech research and things like that, which is already starting to happen because of all the restrictions, for example, on stem cell research in this country. So there's tensions in the coalition itself. They are not on the same page. They have a nice gentleman's handshake going on right now where they're working together because they're both getting plenty of what they need from this administration. But at some point, there may be an issue that breaks that down. On the grassroots level or the ideological level, I think there's a couple interesting issues. One is this question of concern for the poor, and that this is a very important teaching in the Christian Bible. And I think to the extent that Christian liberals, the kind of Jim Wallaces and so on of the world, continue to articulate a challenge that what, you know, devout Christianity should lead people to being very concerned about the welfare of the poor, I think they may offer a very strong theological challenge to some of these folks.
And there are even some evangelicals who are pro-environment, that is. Well,
there was recently the head of the National Association of Evangelicals just signed on to a new Christian environmentalist campaign that actually has decided global warming is a serious issue. And that was a really interesting and very new development. That's on all the issues we've been talking about, the NEA is a very conservative organization. And I think one of the other areas is women's rights. The conservatism of the evangelical movement has been very oppressive to women. The part of what's been happening to our broader culture, which with the Christian right trying to impose its values on the rest of us, has also been happening within the movement. The Southern Baptist Convention used to have a tremendous amount of female leadership, and now, just in the last 10 years, there's been a conservative takeover of the seminary, and they've been purging women. They've been purging even men who believe that women should be able to preach. There's just been a tremendous backlash, and this is a movement that's run heavily on female time and energy and sweat and blood, and they're being just brutally shoved out of leadership positions and off the pulpit. And it'll be interesting to see if at some point there is a backlash to that, because these women are really the energy behind this movement, and how long can they be shoved even out of their own leadership positions and continue to be loyal to the
movement? It sounds like women, environmentalists, and business people can exploit some of these contradictions,
yeah,
and perhaps move things.
Advocates for the poor as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Esther Caplan, a wonderful book, With God on Their Side, George Bush and the Christian Right. Thank you so much for writing this book and for speaking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I guess before I go, I just did want to mention that I am now blogging on a new website, which has a really interesting collection of voices of people who are really trying to track day by day what's happening on the Christian right, how it's affecting our lives. And there's everyone from journalists to liberal Christian clergy who are posting on this, and it's at talktoaction.org.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. That was Esther Caplan, author of With God on Their Side. Next up, we talk with Dr. Tom Plow about asthma after this song.
Long hair preacher come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But if asked for something to eat, he will answer in a voice that's so sweet. You will eat,
you will eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land up in the sky.
Way up high,
work and play, live on hay. You'll eat pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie. And the Starvation Army, they play, and they sing and they clap and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum, and they tell you while you are on the bum. You will eat,
you will eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land up in the sky.
High,
work and play, live on hay. You'll eat pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie. If you fight for the good things in life, they will tell you to stop all the strife. Be a sheep for the bosses, they say, or to hell you will sure be on the way. You will eat,
you will eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land up in the sky.
Way up high.
Work and play, live on hay. You'll eat pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie.
That was The Preacher and the Slave, Pie in the Sky, sung by Peter Siegel off his album Move the Mob. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When journalist Anthony Shadid died on February 16th, it was a shock to all. When I first heard the news that he died on undercover assignment in Syria, I assumed he'd been killed by Syrian government forces. But I was even more shocked to find out that he died of asthma, a condition we don't usually think of as fatal. But almost 5,000 people die every year in the U.S. from the disease. And my next guest says it doesn't have to be that way. Children with Asthma, a manual for parents, Dr. Tom Plow's Asthma Guide for People of All Ages, and his runaway bestseller, 1 Minute Asthma, What You Need to Know. Tom Plow's been treating asthma patients for over 25 years and has developed techniques to help people manage the disease successfully at home. I started out by asking him what he thought might have caused Anthony Shadid to have such a severe attack and whether it could have been prevented.
Well, I don't know the exact details of his death. According to the story in the New York Times, we know some things. That he had asthma, that evidently he treated it and got better, and then he got worse. And they attributed his problem due to contact with horses. And horses are a common trigger of asthma. What I don't know about him is I don't know whether he measured his airflow regularly.
What does that mean?
That means that you have a little device about the size of a small flashlight that you blow into to see whether you can move enough air. And it's inexpensive, costs $30, and it's extremely useful. And the reason it's so useful is that it tells you you've got troubles before you have any signs or symptoms of asthma.
So you think that if he had been using that, he might have been alerted to problems that were developing?
Absolutely. I don't know his situation, but the story, I've heard this story many times. And the thing is, people with asthma don't have many of them don't have a good understanding of how it works in the body. And they don't have the ability to judge its severity. And every one of my patients used a peak flow meter if they are over the age of 4.
Wow. And how does asthma work in the body, and what can they do once they use that meter?
Well, the problem with asthma is that the tubes that carry air in the lungs are narrowed two ways. Number one, they're swollen on the inside and they're tightened on the outside. So you may only get 10% of the airflow that you should get. And this is not rocket science. I've taught thousands of patients how to use a peak flow meter. Most doctors don't recommend them.
Why is that?
There are two reasons. The allergists and pulmonologists don't use them because they say they have a better way to measure airflow. They use a fancy device known as a spirometer. It costs $2,000 to $3,000, and it's better. But guess what? They never go to the patient's house before breakfast to check airflow. So even though it's better, supposedly, it's not useful.
So are you saying that people can use this peak airflow thing, that they should use it throughout the day or just when they're having problems?
Well, when they are first learning about asthma, they ought to use it every day. And they soon learn to sense that their airflow is good or not good. And if they're having any kind of problem, they monitor their airflow and they adjust their medicine according to their airflow.
I see. So what could Anthony, if he'd had one of these, what might he have done if he knew that his airflow was going down?
Well, if he had proper medicine, and there are really three main medicines. If he had a rescue inhaler that puts out something like adrenaline and causes the airways to dilate. He could have used that. He also could have used an inhaled steroid that prevents trouble. And if he had any indication that his status was not satisfactory, he should have been using that every day. And thirdly, if it turned out that things were getting worse, he could have taken an oral steroid that would reduce the inflammation in his airways and give him relief.
Now, I have read that his father said that he always had his medicine with him. Of course, we don't know if in the heat of the work he was doing at that time, he was in Syria undercover, whether he, might not have been paying attention. But can people die of asthma this easily?
The answer is yes. I mean, look, we don't know what medicine he had, number one. Number two, we don't know whether he checked his peak flow, which refers to the best blast you can blow out of this little device. And we don't know what medicine he had, nor do we know what his instructions were for using it. So I've seen patients over and over who use an inhaler incorrectly and get just a small fraction of the benefit they should. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a group of doctors some time ago, 30 of them in the room. I gave each of them an inhaler, and there wasn't a single one who knew how to use it properly.
Wow.
Well, this is a problem.
So you think that asthma, these kinds of deaths can be prevented as long as people have the education?
Yeah. Asthma deaths, it will occur, but they should be very rare. And most doctors do not take the time to explain what goes on in asthma. And even though a national body has recommended that every patient with asthma get a written plan that covers all the possibilities when they get sick, they're rarely used.
And how big of a problem is this in terms of deaths? Do you know how many people do die every year?
Yeah, 5,000 in the U.S.
Wow.
So one out of every 4,000 people with asthma. Now, if you want to look and see what an asthma action plan looks like, you could go to my website at pedipress, pedipress.com, and look for the peak flow diary. And paired with it is an asthma action plan. And that's what it takes.
And we will link to that on Writer's Voice. So, Dr. Tom Plow, I want to thank you so much for talking to us about this. We're out of time for this segment, but we really wanted to bring this information to our listeners. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tom Plow's latest book is 1 Minute Asthma. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.